Well,
David Plouffe, known to millions of people for managing the Obama campaign, known for your emails, I suspect the web videos, and now also for the book, The Audacity to Win. I bet there are many people who actually don't know that much about your story, though. So we'll talk about the politics, we'll talk about the campaign, but I wanted to start off with this. Your first campaign, your first political experience, tell me about it.
Well, I was in college, and I had spent previous summers cleaning chimneys and selling knives door to door, and I was always interested in politics, followed it, and I saw an advertisement in the campus newspaper, and I applied and got a job canvassing, going door to door for a long shot Senate candidate in Delaware who was running in the primary. And we closed an 18-point gap in the last few weeks. And actually, it was a Saturday night primary. We were declared the winner, gave the victory speech. And, you know, I dropped all my classes that Monday morning because I was going to finish out the campaign. And there was a vote count error discovered. And in a precinct, they had given us 2,820 votes instead of 28. And so we were then down 3 and lost by 71. And honestly, I enjoyed that campaign. I'm not sure I would have stayed in politics, because what it taught me was any of us on the campaign, if we had worked a little bit harder, could have swung 36 votes. And it taught, you know, and I believed before that elections matter, and they have great consequences in this country. So that was my first experience, and it was a great experience. But that's really probably why I stuck with politics, is I saw that one person could really make a big difference in elections. And if you happen to think elections are important, you know, that's, I think, a critical thing.
Was it human error? Was there foul play? Was it a hanging chad? What was it?
Yeah, that was before the whole era of conspiracy theories around elections kicked in. No, it was just human error.
And do you think failure, though, was a motivating factor then? Losing the election meant more to you?
Well, I'm not proud of that. That's always been kind of my orientation. If you read the book, I mean, the thing, I really spent a lot of time talking about the mistakes I made, for two reasons. They are the ones that really were imprinted in my mind. And secondly, you know, this was kind of mythologized as a perfect campaign. It was anything but. But yeah, sure, it was the failure. I remember in 1990, then I went to work for Tom Harkin in Iowa. And he taught me that, at least from his viewpoint, he enjoyed watching his opponent concede as much as he enjoyed giving his acceptance speech. And so I've kind of always carried that with me as well.
Well, there's a clue in the title to the book, The Audacity to Win. Obviously, you're playing off the then-Senator's book, The Audacity of Hope. But The Audacity to Win suggests that deep down, maybe not so deep down, you're competitive. You want to win here.
Yeah, well, and I think absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things I like about politics. I mean, I do, other than the Civil War, which is a pretty big exception, we settle disputes in this country at the ballot box. Elections have deep consequences. That's why I've never had a lot of tolerance for, you know, people in my party, you know, complaining. We can complain bitterly about what our opponents are doing, but they won the election. Mm-hmm. They have the agenda. And it doesn't, whether it's city council up to state legislator, governor, or president, you win elections. And so I think they have huge consequences. And yeah, you know, there are some years I was out running a Senate campaign in 1994, thought I ran a really good one. But we couldn't withstand the atmospherics of the moment. So sometimes you can do great and lose, but it's very easy to determine whether you're successful or not. Mm-hmm. You either win or you lose. And it's got a definitive end date. There is absolute clarity. And, you know, I think that's helpful. I think that's also helpful for motivating people, because right. That's what you need to be judged by.
So if winning is the goal here, you know the taste of failure. Look back to 2007. What on earth made you think that you stood any chance of getting a guy called Barack Hussein Obama, a freshman senator with a thin resume, elected president of the United States? I mean, if you were going out to win, if you wanted to make sure a Democrat was going to win, this wasn't a really great shot, was it?
You forgot socialist and
right.
Anti-colonial and all the other things.
Right. It's coming, don't worry.
Yes. Well, and that's one of the reasons I titled the book that. I also titled the book that because you might remember that Reverend Jeremiah Wright's phrase was the audacity of hope. So I thought as much pain as he caused me, I would utilize that word. But we were very clear about how unlikely this was going to be. I mean, crystal clear. I write a lot about this. It's one of the reasons we succeeded, is we understood, and I always think about it in this way. If you ran that primary 100 times, Hillary Clinton would win it 95. Maybe we'd win it 3, and John Edwards, back then, I know it's hard to imagine, would have won it 2, let's say. So we knew that we had to decide strategically what was our narrow pathway to victory, commit everything to it, to be also awfully disciplined, with the full knowledge that even if we did that and executed perfectly, we'd still come up short. Mm-hmm. So that's what was audacious about it. And we embarked on a strategy and the kind of campaign, very grassroots focused, used technology a lot, that wasn't always understood or appreciated by observers or by our opponents, fortunately, until it was too late for them. But that's what made it so unlikely. We were, all of us who signed up for this, thought that this would be a one-year rather than two-year enterprise in all likelihood.
Right. You had been in campaigns before. You actually write very frankly about this in the book, the kind of personal toll that the campaign wreaked on your life, on your family. Knowing that was going to be the case and knowing that this was a long shot, I mean, maybe you didn't think it was going to go on for very long, but was it difficult getting into it?
Absolutely. I, throughout my life, have rarely hesitated in terms of a job direction or offer, whether it was cleaning chimneys or any campaigns. It was either something made sense or it didn't. I've been fortunate that most of my decisions were correct, not all of them, but I just didn't dither very much. Things either were clear or not. And I really struggled over this one. First of all, I had not managed a campaign since 1996. Mm-hmm. I had managed, the national party organization in charge of House races in 2000, but it had been a long time. And there's a lot of difference between consulting and giving advice and being on the hook for everything. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't sure I wanted to do that again or that I would be good at it. Was I rusty? Would I really give myself back over to that? And secondly, it does take a huge personal toll. And so I really struggled over this. And it was my wife who had a lot of reasons to oppose this. And we talked about this at some length, and I knew she wasn't cheerleading for this. So this meant more for me. This was in the middle of the night. I think it was around 3 a.m., a time that became important in our campaign for different reasons. And she said, listen, you are getting more and more cynical about the quality of people running for office, about the quality of campaigns. Now, you have some responsibility for that because you're involved in politics as a profession. So here's this guy that of all the people you've worked with, you seem to really admire. And he says he's going to run the kind of campaign you've always wanted to be involved with. Get people involved, almost kind of a Bobby Kennedy feel. And he's probably not going to win, but that's less important than if you don't do this, aren't you kind of a fraud? Aren't you being hypocritical? And, that turned me around. I said, she's right about that. I don't have any right to complain if I don't give this a shot for somebody that I believed in and I thought would kind of run the right kind of campaign. And, campaigns generally are joyless exercises. There aren't a lot of volunteers involved. It's a lot about TV ads. And this one offered the opportunity to be part of a real movement where it wouldn't be all of us in the campaign headquarters to be joined potentially by, we thought, thousands. It became millions of Americans.
Did you ever think as the personal toll increased, or maybe because you had doubts about the candidate, did you ever look back and say, really, this wasn't such a great idea? And in spite of the 3 a.m. conversation, maybe I should have gone the other way.
No, never in 2007. It was the most fun I've had professionally, partially because, Barack Obama's a sane human being, and most of the people in politics aren't. So there's no strangeness, there's no outsized reactions to small things. He's just a very normal guy. And the team we had around this was, it really became like a family. When we were on the pathway to the nomination, it became clear in 2008 we were going to be the nominee. I did have a conversation with then Barack Obama, then Senator Obama, saying, listen, I'm not sure I can stay on as your manager for the general. My wife and I are due to have our second child 3 days before the election. So she's going to move back to Washington with my son. She'll be 7 months pregnant, and I'll be out of the picture. And, you know, I wasn't sure that I could stomach that. But again, she kind of said, we'll find a way to make this work. So no, never said, what are we doing here? I mean, we kept, in 07, we kept exceeding our own expectations. Mm-hmm. And I understand how rare that is. In most efforts in life, including campaigns, you don't raise as much money, you don't have as much volunteers, you know, your candidate doesn't improve as much. I mean, 2007 was just, now, with the backdrop being most people thought we were dead meat, right? Said, well, right. Yeah, you're raising money and you've got all these volunteers, but Hillary's winning by 30 points. But we knew based on the strategy we were trying to execute that we were doing everything according to plan, but better. And that was a lot of fun to be a part of.
Right. So this is the Kentucky Authors Forum. I want to sort of round this personal section off with an author's question. You talk about the toll through the campaign made you wanted to leave. Writing a book takes a personal toll too. I mean, it's a very different mindset. And how did you feel with that transition, moving into writing? How did your family feel about it?
Well, there was no comparison to the campaign because I'm around. And so, you know, this, and listen, I did not set out to write a book about the campaign. I didn't think there would be anything noteworthy about it. It was clear, and this is a humbling thing, it was really not till right after the election, it was clear, you know, and whether you supported him or not, you know, I think most people agree it was a historic moment. Not just his election, but the kind of campaign we ran, this economic collapse that hung over the campaign, these big figures, McCain, Clinton, Obama. And so, you know, and obviously I had to get approval to write this book from someone who sits at a desk somewhat like this. So, and we, you know, we thought it was important because when too much time elapses, when other people's have filled the fray, and you wrote a great book about the campaign, but this is the campaign through my eyes, and I think through our eyes. Mm-hmm. And we thought that was important too. But I wrote this book mainly, you know, when I was doing traveling, I wrote it, I got on the plane, I really didn't read a book for months because I wrote. If I was on a plane, if I was in a hotel room, at night, at home, I just wrote. And so I was, and because I had a fairly brief period, I had to write the manuscript in 4 or 5 months. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no option at kind of, you know, dilly-dallying or finding escapism. I just had to apply myself. So, but I did write it around my family. I mean, I never wrote, you know, in the morning or at mealtimes or really on weekends. I tried to preserve that family time and filled in around it.
And you went from notes, memory, was it all so fresh there?
Well, mostly memory, although I have all of our calendars and emails and memos. And so, and again, if I had written this book in 3 years, it would have been, I think, not as crisp. And I would have forgotten a lot of, I think, some of the more meaningful exchanges. So, and I obviously had my colleagues from the campaign review it, and they gave me great additions, things I'd missed, correcting dialogue. So it was, and so I had a lot of source material to work from.
Right.
But honestly, it was such a raw experience that this really poured out of me.
So scrolling forward to the present, in fact, the president just had a town hall recently where a number of supporters, the people who were so enthused by what you did in 2008, stand up and say, I was a supporter, and I'm tired of going out there defending the president. I've lost hope. I've lost my enthusiasm. What happened?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm somewhat of a fan of numbers and data. So, you know, most people, the vast majority of them, who voted for the president, and, you know, a huge majority of those that contributed their time or their money or their talent remain steadfast supporters. But of course there's exceptions. So I think that, you know, this is how our media works, right? One person stands up and that becomes
right.
Reality for everybody. And that's obvious. And I think, you know, we're not here to dissect the media of 2010, but someone should do that. But
I think they want you to.
But listen, when you have an economy like this, that again, it's the worst our country has faced since the Great Depression. And obviously our president then, Franklin Roosevelt, did some very important things. But you gotta remember there was a Second World War that really lifted us out of that. Unfortunately, we don't have anything like that in the offing. Mm-hmm. This is gonna be really a tough slog. But so what I say to people like that is, I understand. You know, particularly if you're going through some personal difficulty and anguish, completely understand. You shouldn't have patience. Everyone wants to live the life they think they should, and too many people can't do it today. But if you step back and say, we had 22 straight months of private sector job loss. Now we have 8 straight months of private sector job gain. Not as high as anyone would like, but we're on the right trajectory. We are living in an economic crisis, but that does not excuse lack of action on things like healthcare, energy jobs, education reform, so that we build a stronger foundation, because the competition with countries like China and India is profound. They are ahead of us in some respects, particularly as it relates to energy. Mm-hmm. We have to be the country that's dominant in the new energy economy, as we were in automotive, industrial, technology. Has to be us. It's going to take a lot of work, and a lot of work's been done in the last year and a half to do that. So I say that, first of all, he's trying to both do the short, small, and by the way, look at last year, the Recovery Act, the help for the automotive industry and its millions of workers, more assistance for the financial industry. All of these were stone-cold political losers in the short term. That was clear. That's why I'm proud of what he did, because he knew that we could face, and economists have said this, most economists said, had those things not happened, we would be sitting today in the fall of 10 with unemployment of 18 or 20% in an absolute Great Depression with no growth in the horizon. So no one's satisfied with where we are today, most the president most of all. But are we heading in the right direction? And this is going to air right before the election. Elections are a choice. The former mayor of Boston, Kevin White, has a great expression that says, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. And, you know, that's a discussion that's happening here in Kentucky and elsewhere, and I think it's a position, it's a discussion that I think from a political standpoint, we're well positioned to do pretty well in. So I understand the frustration. And listen, some of it was there were such great hopes built up.
Right.
But the hole that the country has dug itself, and it just wasn't during the last administration. We as a country, and not its people, its leaders. You know, for 100 years we tried to get comprehensive health reform, which is as much an economic issue as it is a health care issue. Didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Every president since Richard Nixon has talked about we have to build a new energy economy and become independent. Hadn't happened. Right? Education reform. We keep doing the same things K through 12. I mean, the student loans were happening the same way, where the bankers were profiting and students were really harmed. You know, that was changed last year. So there's, I'd say that for the first time in a long time, we have leadership that's focused not just on the next election, but on the next generation. And I think that's really, really important.
A lot of people who think they know a lot about politics say, well, maybe healthcare was the right subject, but just not now. There were other priorities, off topic. Maybe another stimulus or another more direct economic issue. Was it the right thing to do at that time?
Sure it was. Well, some people will say, you know, it wasn't the right thing to do because of the politics. I mean, so much of this is viewed in Washington through a political prism. You know, let's say something like the Recovery Act. They'll say, well, I'll get asked, is the Recovery Act a failure? I say, why do you ask that? Well, it's polling 42%. Really, that's the question you ask? Not how many jobs it created, not the impact it had in bringing us out of recession, but it is a game in Washington. It's like watching ESPN. But I actually enjoy ESPN. I don't enjoy any of that. And so, no, it had to be done. And that's what they say in Washington. They'll say, well, not this year, not this congressional session, not before this election. Next thing you know, you're in another election cycle. And I think what the president believes, and listen, as I mentioned, he did some really tough things on the economy last year. But healthcare reform, energy, education reform, we're going to have a big national discussion about the deficit and debt, and a lot of people who are in politics, an observer of politics next year will say, how on earth can you have this discussion in your reelection year? And, you know, he has a responsibility gene, something that I think is in short supply in Washington, which is, this is serious stuff. It's not about the Daily Gallup poll. It's not about, with the exception of Richard Wolff, the commentators on TV.
I'm glad you made that exception. Thank you.
And, you know, it's like figure skating judges. I give him a 6.2 today. Right. I mean, you know, you've and sort of that longer-term horizon But that obviously does not mean that you're not doing everything you can in the short term. I mean, that's the real problem right now, is we have acute short-term problems, economy most pressing. Mm-hmm. But we also have ignored these long-term problems and opportunities. And I think his belief is, you know, it's not worth sitting in that Oval Office if you're not going to try and address each and every one of them.
Well, speaking of the moment, some people have suggested, some people on the right, people like Charles Krauthammer, for instance, have said it was a fluke. 2008 was a massive fluke. There was one moment when this man could be elected. It was the economic crisis, the legacy of Bush. Is he right? Was this a unique moment for Barack Obama, 2008? I know you won't want to agree with Charles Krauthammer on anything.
No, I mean, I hadn't seen that. I mean, it's on the scale of ridiculous pontification, kind of on the extreme end. I mean, it really is. No, I think what you saw in 2008, and listen, 2006 was a change election, so was 8. You know, 10 may have elements of it too. I don't think 2012 will be a change election. But voters, citizens of this country are usually ahead of Washington. And they are just hungering for leadership. They're actually hungering for their leaders to get along a little bit better, something that people on the extreme left and extreme right don't necessarily never agree with, really, but needs to happen. They are hungry for us. You go to any suffering community, and there's too many in the country, and you ask the people who live there, okay, it's 2025. Our country and your community have recovered and are prospering. Why is that? They go right to energy jobs and healthcare technology and K-12 reform. They get this. They get this. They make so much more sense than so many of the, you know, the folks in Washington who are kind of yelling past each other. And so, you know, I don't believe it was a moment in time. I think people are hungering for leadership. They're hungering for, when I say change of direction, I mean, I think one of the things that was core to why Obama ran and won was people really thought, okay, this guy's kind of not of Washington. You know, maybe he'd be willing to take some of these tough fights on. And there's no doubt, because a lot of the things that have been done over the last year and a half required Congress. You know, you become seen as a little bit more of an insider, a price he knew he would pay, and more than willing to pay it because you needed to accomplish these things. So no, you know, I think that, you know, listen, I don't think mainstream Republicans, but kind of the Republican commentary class, and, you know, they're kind of in a state of, you know, elation right now, thinking that they're going to have a great 10, and that means they're going to have a great 12 and great 14 and great 16. If there's any moment to talk about, it's they may momentarily have political success, but I think they are resigned to great political defeat in the coming years.
We're going to come to the election soon, but I wanted to ask this. You kind of suggested there was maybe too much hope and anticipation for what the president could do. There was a bad economy as well that accounts for some of the frustrations, a lot of the frustrations. But one of the things he spoke about from the 2004 convention speech through the campaign was about uniting red and blue America. Clearly, that hasn't happened. If anything, things have got worse. So I don't want to compare him to the Almighty in his powers or what he's promised, but that was a promise that he could do it, he could find that common ground. Was he too hopeful? Were people too gullible to believe that could happen? What did happen?
Oh, I don't think anybody expected, you know, the city would be strewn with rose petals between, you know, Congress and the White House. Here's what I would say. You know, first of all, this is something he deeply believes in. And, you know, when I travel around the country, and particularly if I'm out there campaigning in Democratic audiences, I will invariably get questions that say, why does he keep talking to the Republicans? And I understand, I guess, the sentiment. He's always going to do it. He believes that this is an important way that we can rebuild trust, which is really important, is to try and be reasonable, to try and have a lower tone. You know, in the campaign and now, you know, if they go low, it doesn't mean you have to go lower. And to a lot of, you know, really, I mean, you know, principled, well-meaning Democrats, they don't agree with that. Mm-hmm. But that's who he is. This is the authentic Barack Obama, and he's going to try and see if there's common ground. Now, when common ground is not achievable, like on healthcare, you've got to move on. But it's also just rhetoric every day, and it's you can contrast without demonizing. And most, if you look at polling today, most Americans, so well over 50%, in some polls it's 58, 60, 62, think the president has genuinely tried to reach out to the other side. They're the ultimate arbiters. Mm-hmm. When you ask that about the Republican Congress, it's like 10%. It's about the favorable rating of the Ebola virus, who think that. So listen, and I would say this, that a lot of Republicans around the country don't believe this, but the congressional Republicans made a decision very early to not participate in trying to make progress on a lot of these issues. And, you know, maybe that will give them some short-term political success. I actually believe it's not in the interest of the country, but I also think it's not in their long-term political interest. So he's tried to do that. And I think, you know, if you look at, you know, his interviews, his speeches, his discussions, he said in his inaugural speech that the time for childish things is over. And he really believes that. And I think that's listen, if you talk to average voters out there, and the folks in the audience tonight, I think would concur with this. I mean, one of the things that drives people crazy is, here's their elected leaders. At not a normal time, the country's in deep economic crisis. And we have all these other unmet challenges. And yet it's like the same old, same old. You know, people are sort of playing short-term politics. They're yelling at each other, scoring political points. A lot of people are abandoning career-long held positions so that they can oppose the president unanimously in the other party. And I think people are tired of it.
Well, that begs the question, has the Republican Party changed in the last 18 months or 2 years? I mean, to put it differently, if you're reaching out to a reasonable Republican, is Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, I believe he's known to this crowd, is Mitch McConnell a Bob Dole?
That does Senator Dole a great disservice. On healthcare, by the way, you know, Bob Dole, a lot of Republicans over the years had proposed a lot of the ideas that were in the healthcare plan. A lot of the Republicans who call this the worst thing that happened to America since I don't know what supported a lot of the individual components. So this was mainly about politics, not principle, and people see through it. Listen, I'm not in the business of giving advice to the Republican Party, but I'm glad they did not do this. It was clear from the moment of our historic election on November 4th, when you looked at all the Democrats who had won election that night, with the economy as bad as it was going to be, and no one was under any illusion in our camp it was going to be really much better. You know, it's not like the unemployment rate was going to drop precipitously. We were in a really deep hole, that we were going to have a really tough 2010. So the Republicans knew early that this was going to be a challenging political environment for us. And so we were going to be at a moment of, if not weakness, challenge. That would be the time to say, okay, we've heard you the last couple elections. We get it. Here's the new Republican Party. More idea-focused. I would have found a couple ways to cooperate with the president easily. And listen, when Olympia Snow or Susan Collins or even Scott Brown, of all people, they voted for financial reform and some other things, they deserve a lot of credit, because in this modern Republican Party, that is not tolerated. It takes an enormous amount of courage for them to do that. Because you look at Tom Coburn, the senator from Oklahoma, who's never supported us on anything. He was at a town hall meeting, and somebody said something really nasty about Speaker Pelosi. And he said, essentially, I don't agree with anything she stands for or does. You know, but she's a nice person. And he was just excoriated for that comment. Mm-hmm. You are just not, Mike Castle, who lost his race, said, essentially, you know, I lost, and all this money came in against me from the outside of my state, because a few times during my career I've decided to work with the other party. That is now a sin. Think about that. And so the Republican Party is all based on opposition. I don't think that's a long-term strategy for renewal. And now the more extreme elements of the Republican Party have taken over. And the truth is, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner do not lead the Republican Party. Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and Sarah Palin do.
Well, let me turn this around, because the president has come in for a lot of criticism from the left. So have Democrats changed over the last 18 months to 2 years? I mean, I went through the whole campaign and heard lots of candidates talking about health care. All the Democrats talked about health care. Nobody mentioned the public option. And yet in Congress, in the left-wing commentariat, everyone wanted to talk about the public option. So did Democrats change as well in this last period?
Well, first of all, I'd say this. Again, with the important caveat that there are exceptions to what I'm going to say, and some loud exceptions and some important exceptions. Again, most of the Democratic Party base, again, they're not going to go in everything, is very satisfied with what the president and many people of his party have tried to do. Now, I think part of it is you win, you have big majorities, you know, and people say, you know, I want my ideal, you know, what I think the ideal is. And it is interesting on health care. The health care plan that he signed into law is remarkably similar to what was proposed during the campaign. It's not like there was backsliding from that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, I think people really, and they are, and these people are not, this isn't, you know, some selfish, you know, they feel that they have some ideas about what's best for the country. They'd like to see it accomplished from a policy-wise, and when you fall short, they can get upset by that. But I think if you're, again, but most Democrats, if you look at, you know, the way the economic issues were addressed, they were all focused on, you know, the middle class, small businesses. We've had huge fights over unemployment insurance to make sure that those are most vulnerable, do not fall off the cliff. Healthcare reform, we've tried for 100 years under Republican and almost every Democratic president. We finally get it done. There's a whole new energy industry spawning out there. We now have kids that are going to have student loans, you know, directly given to them instead of through the banks. $60 billion are going to go to kids rather than to the big banks. Financial reform, which is going to protect consumers and make sure what happened on Wall Street doesn't happen again. I mean, this is very important stuff. And I think that and again, some people aren't going to be swayed by me. They shouldn't be. They'll say, but my message is, if you're a Democrat, get out of the fetal position, be proud of what we've done, and understand what's coming down the pike if these Republicans take back Congress, because no one in this country is going to be well served by that. So that's my view.
Okay. We talked about Republicans, Democrats, but independent voters were a real goal of the campaign of the president as a candidate. Independent voters have trended sharply away from the president. What's happened to them? How did he lose them?
Well, first of all, we haven't lost them. I mean, independent. If you look at the independent voter universe of 2010 versus 2008, it is more conservative because some Republicans left their party and have become independents. And obviously, the 2010 electorate is much different than the 2008 electorate. Moderates who participate in independents who participate in presidential elections, there's a lot more moderates. Independents who participate in off-year elections, there tends to be more conservatives. And independent voters in this country fluctuate wildly. That's to be expected. He is still, by far, the most popular political figure or institution in the country with independent voters. But independent voters, obviously, they're, like everybody else, upset with the economy. And so right now the Republican Party nationally has an edge. In some states, it's a big edge. In some states, Democrats still have an edge. Independent voters are not monolithic. Northeastern independent voters different than Southern, different than the West. So, but listen, he is not judging his job through the prism of any of this. He's simply saying, okay, I've got a set of decisions to make. About how we're going to move the country forward. I've got a set of foreign policy decisions to make, and sort of the politics will be the politics. But I obviously do follow politics occasionally. And, you know, the truth is, there's all this discussion about, you know, the president's approval rating, it's sinking. Okay, listen, he got 53% of the vote. And if the electorate had been the same as it's been in most presidential elections, it would have been 50-50. The reason we won by what's considered a modern landslide is all the new young voters, minority turnout was much higher than we've seen. We're still a very divided country. Those 47% of people who voted against us did not do so casually, right? So I compare his numbers to his vote number, not to some artificial number around the inaugural. And in polls of 2010 voters, which is not nearly as friendly as the 8 electorate or the 12 electorate will be, You know, he's anywhere from 45 to 48 in this economy. I mean, I thought he'd be 30 or 32 now. What? Reagan, you know, was at 34, 36 this time. And if you look at his approval rating amongst those who are presidential year voters, it's right around his vote total.
So I'm
sort of fascinated by this. And, you know, luckily, commentators are beginning to focus more on the Republican Party because it looks like they could have a good election, and are they going to get more power, and what does that mean? And look at their numbers. Their numbers in some polls are worse than they were in 2008. So, you know, this is not, what's going on right now is not some budding love affair in the offing between the American voter and Mitch McConnell and John Boehner or Rush Limbaugh. It's that people are frustrated. And when they're frustrated, you know, they're going to say, well, you know, should we try an alternative? And I think, you know, as Democrats, we have to understand that.
So why are the people, the young voters, the minority voters, all the polling suggests they're not going to show up? The people that you communicated directly with and fused with the campaign, and obviously you had a candidate who was doing that too, but those people don't seem to be interested in voting this time. Why not?
Well, first of all, it's really hard. It was the hardest thing we do to get those people to vote, and that was for Barack Obama, a historic, transcendent candidate on the verge of, you know, a very special moment. Think about that. It was really hard, and a lot of people we didn't succeed with. But people assume that somehow, like, okay, you know, in 2010, this is a replay of 2008. You know, we had a lot of money. We had millions of volunteers. We had great intensity. We're not on the ballot this time. We're not running a campaign. Candidates are, and we're doing everything we can to help them. I learned a long time ago, the only campaign you control is the one you're running, and half the time it's out of your control. Okay? So what we're trying to do, but again, we're not asking them to go out and cast a vote for Barack Obama. We may say the Republicans are going to threaten the Obama agenda, they're attacking, they're opposing, so, you know, go vote for Jack Conway or go vote for Barbara Boxer. But you got to understand, that's harder than what we did in 08 by a huge factor. Because these voters you're talking about still approve of the president by astronomical numbers. But first of all, they don't really follow politics, a lot of them. A lot of them, when we talk to them now, say, well, you know, is who's on the ballot? Do I have to re-register? You know, can I vote by absentee like I did? I don't know anything about the candidates. So there's a huge barrier. And so we're trying to encourage, we're doing all we can through, you know, internet, email. The president's doing a lot to try and say this is an important election. Your participation was so important in 08, we need you to stay, get out again. But the campaigns also have to go out there and build a relationship with these people. Because if they don't, they're not going to come out. It was hard enough to get people to vote for Barack Obama. If they don't have some sense of why that particular race is important and why that candidate is worth voting for, they're not going to vote. Now, I do think some of these voters have been motivated by Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Angle and Rand Paul around the country. So some of it may be, well, you know, my motivation is I don't want to hand the keys over to those people. So that's a helpful atmospheric out there, but it's really hard. And you got to think, off-year and on-year elections are fundamentally different. Mm-hmm. You know, we had roughly 140 million people vote in 08. You may have 80 million people vote this time. And I can assure you the 60 million people that drop off are not the people who are Rand Paul, Christine O'Donnell voters. They tend to be more moderate, a lot of Democrats, so it's hard work. Well, and the notion that it can just be turned on and off is not. Now, what does that mean for 12? Who knows? But I have a lot
can
of...
Can you get them to show up again? I mean, if it was hard getting them to come out for a historic opportunity, will they do it to re-elect what is no longer a historic first?
Absolutely. It's going to take a lot of work, and we're going to have to really communicate with people, but absolutely. Now, we won't have to work too hard if Sarah Palin's their nominee, but...
Is she going to be? Seriously. If you had to make a prediction.
Something tells me we won't be that lucky. But I'll say this. First of all, if she ran, she'd have a very, very credible chance to be the Republican nominee. And whether she runs or whoever runs, their nominee is going to have to be someone who does exceedingly well with kind of the Beck, Limbaugh, Palin, Rand Paul, Christine O'Donnell voter. That is the strength and power in the Republican Party right now. And those are the people who are going to come out in big numbers in primaries and caucuses. So whoever they nominate, it's going to be someone who's kind of had to run that obstacle course on the far right. And, you know...
So if it's not her, who would it be?
I have no idea. Listen, this time, 4 years ago,
There were very few people who took seriously the notion of a Barack Obama candidacy, much less presidency, including me. So there will be people we're sure are going to run who might not. There may be some dark horses. Who knows where things will sit in the country in terms of foreign policy and the economy in 12 or 14 months.
And why do you think she wouldn't do it?
Oh, I wouldn't even dare to get into her head.
When you look... I'm just gonna think about that for a second. When you look at the rise of the Tea Party, you look at the rise of a candidate, a success of a candidate like Christine O'Donnell, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I'd say this. I mean, the president actually spoke about this yesterday. You know, the Tea Party, there's a long tradition of people in our campaign of sort of just average people kind of getting together to be engaged in politics. And by the way, I don't agree with much of anything they do, but I generally think that's a healthy thing. Now, you know, I think that the candidates who've won, Rand Paul here, Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Engel, there's a lot in the House races that are not national names, but give us a better chance to win House races, you know, are seen as out of the mainstream. Obviously, Kentucky is a tougher state for my party than Delaware's. Delaware is a, you know, used to be purple state, it's a blue state now. You know, there's a poll that came out today that had her down 15. Castle would have been up 15, a 30-point swing. And that's all moderates, and it's increased Democratic enthusiasm. So what is the Tea Party movement? And by the way, it's becoming more corporatist. You've got a lot of people out there who are funding it. And I think it's ultimately an unholy alliance between the members of the Tea Party who are just out there working hard and, you know, the Karl Roves of the world. And I think that will be, they're probably in an unholy alliance through this election. I think you might see that explode over time. The Tea Party is not getting independents or Democrats. This is all the Republican Party. And so we should not overstate that this is some explosive movement that's gathering conservative Democrats and independents. It's not doing that. What it will do is ensure high Republican turnout, because some of these really conservative, disaffected Republicans who might not have voted in 06 because of the corruption issues, who might not have been wild about McCain, and Palin wasn't enough to get them out the door, they'll vote. And, you know, that's important in politics. So, I mean, that when I look at it, that's what's been important, is that it's going to guarantee high Republican turnout across the board, and turnout is ultimately an important factor. But it's also caused the nomination of many people who are going to have difficulty winning general elections. And I think this is just in its infancy. I think in 2011 and 2012, the country is going to be littered, including at the presidential level, with people who do very well at the far right of the Republican Party. And I think in 2012, when you have a lot more moderate voters, turnout's going to be higher amongst, you know, core Democratic groups. You know, I do think the economy will be healing more. The reality of health care will be replaced with the fiction, and that will be helpful. That this all could spell big, big problems for them in 2012. But that's my sense. And by the way, you see, you know, the Republican leadership in Washington, you know, I mean, they are following the orders of Limbaugh, Beck, Palin, and this whole wing of the party. I mean, occasionally you've seen them go out there and say somewhat critical things about one of them, and they get slapped down and they apologize. That is the power, and they dare not be crossed.
You seem to suggest that maybe Kentucky's out of reach. I just want to be clear. We're 6 weeks out.
Yeah.
It is, since we're here. How do you think this is going to play
out?
My
point was that Delaware is such a even in a tough year like this, it is a democratically oriented state. Kentucky obviously is tougher for us, but we have, if you look at the numbers of how does someone like Jack Conway get to 50% in Kentucky, it is doable. It is absolutely doable. We have a number of House races here too, so Kentucky is going to play an important role in this election, but no. I mean, I think that, but if you look at that, so again, what I thought, I never thought that the kind of, and I hate to use the, it's not just the Tea Party. I never thought that the election of these really, really conservative, out-of-the-mainstream Republican candidates would become a national effect, where actually someone sitting in, you know, New Mexico or Colorado might be inclined to contribute or volunteer or vote because of some of these candidates. And that's what we're seeing. Remarkable. It's really enthused, galvanized Democrats. But in these particular states, that's nothing to sneeze at. I mean, they thought Delaware was a walk. It may not be. Sharon Engel, obviously the weakest opponent Harry Reid could have drawn, and here in Kentucky, a race many people thought would be completely off the boards, is highly competitive. I mean, you see all the outside money being spent here in Kentucky on the Republican side. They don't think it's a done deal.
While we're just tripping through some races here, the flip side would be, how can a state like Wisconsin be in such trouble for Democrats? What, is it just the economy?
Well, Wisconsin is a traditional fierce battleground. I mean, it was, if you look at Gore, Bush, Kerry Bush, it was the closest election in both of those years. And we won it by a big number, you know, but it is traditionally a toss-up state. And a lot of independents there, and independents obviously move around a lot, you know, and the Republicans will do a lot better with them this time than they did in 08. So, and, you know, we have incumbents, any incumbent out there that's in anything close to a competitive district in either party is going to have a really tough election. And so we have, you know, Senator Feingold's an incumbent. He's going to have a tough election. But I think a lot of these, you know, incumbent senators of ours, they're going to have tough races. You know, Boxer, Feingold, Murray, they're going to run strong races.
You've kind of suggested that campaigning is a clear result. You win or you lose. Governing is, I guess, much more difficult. You chose not to go into the White House yourself. So we're talking about this from a comfortable distance. But why didn't you go into the White House?
Well, first of all, I think it was Charles de Gaulle who said, you know, the cemeteries are littered with indispensable men. And so I'm of the belief that everybody at the staff level in any enterprise is not indispensable and completely replaceable. But, you know, my personal decision, and this was something I talked about even prior to the election, not to jinx it, but was because I had we were going to have a new child, and I had spent a lot of time away from my family, I just couldn't give 2 years of my life like that. Knowing that I'd probably have to give two again, I wasn't willing to do six in a row. And, you know, listen, it's, you know, everybody's different. The kind of life I want to live is to be very involved with my children, to have some schedule flexibility, to see them a lot, to spend time with my wife, you know, to see my parents. I saw them once in 2 years. You know, I didn't want to do that for another 2 years. So the president, you know, was accepting of that and has only on occasion attempted to revisit it. And so basically, and that's not because of any, it's just, you know, when you go through a war, you know, you have a good relationship. And, you know, I have said that after 2 years, if there is a need and a desire, and he's got a great team around him who are doing great work, then I certainly would be willing to put my life out of balance again and give myself back over. And if that happens, I will do so with, you know, pure exhilaration and excitement, some trepidation on the personal side of things.
So,
but, yeah.
Are you about to? Are we at that point?
Very premature. You know, I still spend a lot of time, obviously, with my former colleagues, and I'm amazed at those who went through the campaign for 2 years. You know, who are, you know, this is essentially going to be a 4-year grueling experience. And what's interesting, though, to a person, they all say it is such a remarkable privilege and pleasure to work at the White House, to serve the American people, to serve this president. And so, in many ways, it's easier than the campaign. For that reason, you understand that, you know, this is such a special perch to be entrusted with. And like in the campaign, you know, people for the most part get along pretty well. So, you know, at the end of every 2 years, obviously, you know, people make decisions to stay or go. How I fit into all that, I have no idea. And I know ultimately I have little control over it. So, you know, I was with my son playing soccer at 4 p.m. yesterday. And, you know, I did take a moment to say, I'm not sure how many more of these I'll have. So I treasured it. And, you know, if that has to go away for a while, it's for a bigger purpose, and we'll all do it as a family and be excited for it, because it's important. I believe in this president. I believe in the trajectory. And I believe that to hand the keys back over at the presidential level to that other party, particularly because it will be people who are on the far right of that party, would be an absolute disaster for the country. And we all who believe that need to do everything we can to prevent it.
One point people make comparing the campaign to the White House is they say, such a great communications effort in the campaign. In the White House, we don't see the same kind of emotion or the same kind of connection. Would you have done things differently, at least on the communication side of things?
No, here's, if you look at the campaign, there were plenty of moments, and they were lengthy, where people were not cheerleading our communication efforts. Right, when you win, things kind of take on a mythology. I remember the day after the election, the New York Times had their big, you know, historical headline about Barack Obama. And their kind of news analysis piece was, flawless campaign delivers Obama the White House. I'm like, I don't know what campaign you witnessed, but this was far from flawless. And you remember this. It was, he's not connecting, he doesn't talk in sound bites, you know, he's not hitting back hard enough. So, you know, you win, it's all, oh, that was great. So that's not, you know, and so, listen, in the campaign, you know, Kentucky was not a battleground state, sadly. But many of you might have traveled to states or had family in states that were. And in those battleground states, you know, Barack Obama would be giving a speech on a Tuesday, Joe Biden on a Thursday, Michelle Obama on a Saturday. We would have blanket television ads, internet ads, people at doors, you know, all over the phones. I mean, it wasn't just the speeches or the interviews. It was a coordinated, intense, massive effort to communicate message. Now, we don't have that. We have the presidential pulpit, which is awfully powerful, but in the old days, you know, a president would give not even a primetime speech. He'd make a statement in the Rose Garden, and almost everybody in the country would consume it. That's not the way it is anymore. There's more and more people in this country who never get original news. They only get it when it's shared with from somebody in their family or social network. So,
is that a healthy thing?
Well, again, here's what I would say. The thing I'm concerned about is less the digital change, because I think it's empowering in some respects. There's parts of it that are concerning. I do think there's more and more people in this country who only want to consume their point of view. And I think as we're, all of us over time here are going to be able to design the newspapers we get. We already do that with RSS feeds. You know, we're not going to really listen to the other side. I mean, the president gave a commencement speech at the University of Michigan this year where he talked about this, that we both need to spend, if you're, most people in this country, by the way, are not partisans of either party. But those that are should spend more time kind of looking across the fence a little bit and trying to understand the others. That doesn't mean you're going to change your mind. So that concerns me. But on communication, you know, listen, I think that, you know, he's given some well-received speeches recently about the stakes of this election, how he sees it. I thought the town hall yesterday for all the, was I thought, you know, really important, because I do think he was answering questions directly. He's doing a lot of unconventional things like The View, because that's, you got to reach people out there. But, you know, I think it's a little bit unfair because, first of all, you know, you could have the best laid communication plan in the world at the White House and an oil spill or a national security event or Shirley Sherrod or something will intrude on it. And that becomes not just the contretemps of the moment, it could consume weeks. And so, but I do think that, but so I look back at the campaign and say, there are things we could have done differently and better. Of course you'd say that now. But I think for the most part, and listen, I think, again, some of these criticisms are the same, you know. He seems too calm, and he doesn't talk in sound bites. And, you know, he didn't do that in the campaign either. He didn't. I can't tell you how many debates we participated in where voters judged us the winner, and the media said, this guy, you know, Hillary had the good sound bite, or Edwards did, or Richardson did. And, you know, I think he's engaged in just trying to be honest with people about the challenges, what he's trying to do. And part of it is when you're perceived to be doing well politically, then everything you're doing is great, right? And when you're perceived to be struggling, then everything's going wrong. And the truth, I think, is actually somewhere in the middle.
So how do we get to a situation where in the campaign, all you had to deal with was, apart from everything else, was the email rumors that he was a Muslim. Now he's a socialist, he's born in Kenya and a Muslim and a terrorist sympathizer. I mean, the rumors and the extreme descriptions of him seem to be growing, not shrinking. What has happened? Is it not being able to deal with the multiple rumor mills that are now there, or is it just the technology has allowing this stuff to happen?
But we dealt with all that in the campaign. I mean, the last 3 weeks of our general election was all about Joe the plumber and us being a socialist. So, you know, all those things you mentioned we dealt with. Here's what I would say. When Barack Obama was elected president, a fairly significant portion of the Republican Party, and so it was anywhere from, depending on a state, 10 to 18% of the people thought he was a Muslim, believed a lot of these things. It's a little bit higher than that nationally. Why? Because more Republicans believe it. That's all this is, that more Republicans who've stiffened in their opposition to him are willing to believe anything. You know, he's not born here. Hawaii's not a state. You know. I want the government out of my Medicare and Social Security.
Right.
So, so they believe these things. So it's not like, here's what I would say from a political standpoint. I'm not concerned that there's a single persuadable voter for Barack Obama in 2012 that believes these things. So I think that there was one poll that really put the number at an extreme number, and that's kind of kicked a lot of this off. But, you know, I see a lot of data, and so it's slightly higher than it was in 2008, and it's almost all Republicans who've hardened their opposition. And when you ask, you know, various questions about Barack Obama, you know, is he the reason that it's 96 degrees in Hubin in Kentucky today? Yes.
Now I know who to blame.
You know, so, you know, that's just the deal.
What happens if unemployment doesn't come down substantially before 2012? If we're still, say, 8, 9%, which actually is not an unreasonable forecast, so are we still going to be in this political environment for the re-election?
Who knows? I mean, listen, I still think there's a few turns of the wheel between now and November 2nd. There's thousands of them between now and November of 2012. I think what the president would say is, well, all he's concerned about is not the election, but, you know, are we doing the right things so that we're on the right trajectory? And I think it's pretty clear, unless most economists are wrong, we're not going to have some precipitous drop. This is going to be a grind. As he talked about in his inaugural address, this is going to take a long time because we're simply not waiting for the jobs to come back. Some of them will come back, but we need whole new industries and whole new areas of emphasis. So who knows what 2012 will hold? All I know is that there'll be a fundamental question for people about whether they think we're on the right trajectory or not. And if not, then it really is a choice between going back, because I don't think this will change between now and 2012. Most national Republicans, when asked what they want to do, they're not really anxious to engage in the conversation. But when they're pinned down, when someone like Mitch McConnell actually has to answer questions, he will say, and they will say, we're essentially, we're going to do the same things we did when we were in control. As if they were innocent bystanders to the economic crisis. It was their policies that were a main contributor to the greatest economic calamity this country's faced, the Great Depression. And if they had their way, the things that were done last year, the Recovery Act, more assistance, the automotive, we wouldn't have done them. We'd be sitting in the middle of the Great Depression. Do you really want to hand the keys back over to the people who drove the car into the ditch?
I've heard that somewhere before.
Yes. So, and that'll be the question in 12. Now, and again, the important thing is no one satisfied with where we are today. You can't be. I think there's real glimmers there. We are seeing growth. It's not fast enough. I do think we're laying a better foundation because of healthcare, because of energy, education. Our relationship with the rest of the world is vastly improved, and that helps with exports and our companies, and many people attest to that. But, you know, this is a really, really tough situation we find ourselves in. And so I think the question is, it's all people's perspective. You know, will they think that we're heading in the right direction? And also they'll ask what the alternative is. And also it's not just, you know, you've also got to tell people where you're heading. And I think that's an important thing for Democrats today who are running for office, is this just shouldn't be an arbitration about what we've done. I think we should be proud about that. But it's also about where we see the next 2 years versus the Republicans. And I think candidates who are doing a good job of making this a choice between two people in a district or a state are having some effect. Because again, unlike 94, when the Republicans nationally were really a blank slate, people said, you know, we'll give them a try. When you remind people, scratch the surface and remind them about what the Republican experiment had been, and it just recently ended, You know, people aren't all that anxious to go back. And I think for this election, the biggest challenge we face is simply the electorate. It is right now too conservative and too Republican. And if we can get Democratic turnout up to a respectable level, we will have a much better election than people think. That's the single most important thing we can do as a party.
One last question. When does the 2012 campaign begin? Do you have to stop playing soccer with your son?
Well, you know, I think that the Republican primary has already begun. Sarah Palin, after all, was in Iowa this weekend. But, you know, there'll be a time for that. You know, it doesn't have to start right away. It will be longer than I think anybody wants. Well, the Republican primary is going to start. I mean, listen, you can already see, I mean, in the media and political observers, even the, you know, it's almost like, can we be done with 10 so we can move on to 11 and 12? And so, listen, the Republicans will be running around Iowa and South Carolina and New Hampshire in the days come after the election, and their process will start. And at some point, you know, we'll have to get organized and start preparing for that. But, you know, it doesn't have to happen right away.
And does that mean you just are bystanders while the Republicans are doing this?
I wish we could be, because I think it's a fascinating sort of, you know, dynamic there. And you know, now there was a civil war. The civil war has been decided. You know, Christine O'Donnell, Rand Paul, and Sharon Engel in there have won. But no, of course, you've got to pay attention to what they're saying about, you know, the president. And I will be interested in what they're doing in a technology standpoint. So this isn't all just evaluating the nasty things they're saying. It's also to kind of watch and see what kind of campaign they're running, and are they striking a chord, and how are they using technology. And so, no, we'll have to watch that carefully, because one of them will ultimately be staring across the ring from you. And so you want to know as much about them, understand them, and see how they, because here's the thing, a presidential campaign is flawed in many ways. You would attest to this for all the time you spent on the road away from your family. It is too long, it can be too banal at times, it is too expensive. But it is very transparent, and it tests people. Mm-hmm. It is a crucible, and you really can't hide who you are. And so we'll be able to see these people run against each other and try and conquer that obstacle course. And, you know, we'll have a much fuller measure of who the Republican nominee is because of that. Now, some of them, the former governor of Alaska won, might just try to, you know, through tweets and Facebook posts, get elected president. But people will demand a lot more than that. They will want serious interaction and dialogue, and they will want candidates to be tested, as they should. We're electing a president, after all.
Okay.
And these people need to be tested.
Well, David Plouffe, I hope we both get to spend some more quality time with our children and family before the next election starts. Thank you for your time tonight. Thank you for writing The Audacity to Win, and thank you to the Kentucky Authors Forum for an hour of time, which in this media environment is very rare. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Is the Tea Party and their fiscal message really just a front for a new cultural war?
Well, I think almost all these questions are ones that Richard also is going to have things to contribute to. So
that's good.
I will jump in.
Take the first step.
Yes. Here's what I'd say about the fiscal situation. Obviously, a lot of people who have become more active in politics through the Tea Party are almost as angry as the Republicans in Washington as they are at the Democrats. I mean, that's why people like Mike Castro are losing and people like Rand Paul are getting elected. And so one of the reasons they're deciding to lift their voices is they didn't like, we went from, you know, Bill Clinton left a big surplus and we went to record deficits. They didn't like how that happened. So it'll be interesting next year, no matter what happens this November. You know, we have majorities, they have majorities, we don't know yet what's going to happen. I think the former. But, you know, for a lot of these folks, this is kind of a moral issue too. You know, the debt and the deficit. So there'll be a lot of pressure on some of these Republicans in Congress who are giving great speeches now about spending, whose votes caused the problem in the first place. My guess is when the rubber hits the road, you know, they're going to be a little recalcitrant about actually trying to participate in getting a handle on the debt and deficit long term, because there's no easy solutions. Every choice is going to be politically hard. And so it'll be interesting to see whether the Tea Party members, you know, sort of put a lot of pressure on the Republicans on this or not. And, you know, it would be interesting. Some of these Tea Party candidates who've been elected with a lot of Tea Party support will win. And it'll be interesting whether how faithful they stay to their campaigns. Or once they get in Washington, do they say, the most important thing to me is staying here? And so that's going to be an interesting dynamic to see. And I think it's going to be fascinating because, again, as I mentioned in our conversation with Richard, the president is bound and determined to try and do some really hard things around the debt and deficit and in his reelection year. And, you know, I think the only way you're going to succeed is with some help from the other party. I think most Democrats will be inclined to do the right thing, as we did under Bill Clinton in 1993. Did some really hard things around the deficit, and that was one reason that we had such economic growth throughout that decade. But we'll need some help to do it. And I think that will be an interesting dynamic, because I think for a lot of the Tea Party grassroots people, and again, I don't disagree with pretty much anything they say, but I don't think they really see this as some game just to get elected. You know, I think they want some of these people they're supporting to actually do something about the debt and deficit. So we'll see.
Yeah, my feeling about the Tea Party is that there are a number of different strains that are in this coalition, if it is that organized. And there's a libertarian element that wants smaller government, and there's a fiscal conservative element that is very concerned about the deficit. I don't think the fire of the Tea Party comes from either of those things, to be honest. I think there are a couple of things that are driving the politics of the moment on. And one is most obviously recession. And although we're well out of a recession, although the media actually talks as if, and I say that collectively, we talk as if the recession is still ongoing. We know officially it's been over for more than a year, but recessions do strange things to politics and to individual psychology, because people feel under threat. They feel their terrible strains in their family, and they want someone or something to blame. So that's why there are these big shifts in politics around recessions, and especially coming out of a recession. In the recession, there's more of a sense of crisis. Coming out, it can be slow, and that's a big factor. But the other aspect of it is there's a president called Barack Hussein Obama, and that gets, I think, to the cultural issues here. Some of the politics, for instance, the post 9/11 politics, the debate, if you can call it that, about the Muslim center, the Islamic center, close to the 9/11 site or in Lower Manhattan, that debate was really, I think, a reflection of, you can call them cultural concerns, but there are a number of voters represented by the Tea Party who feel that the election of President Obama was a direct threat to their cultural identity. And whether that's because of his name or his complexion or anything else or his politics is really unclear, and I'm not sure it's even worth spending the time sort of separating them out. So I think there's a combination of the economy, of the time, of this president that makes it partly cultural. But it's all of those things together that give the Tea Party that the cohesion that it has, and certainly the dynamism that it has.
Next question.
Yes, my question for, and this is basically for both of you, and it's several parts. Like, when it comes to the media, and I must admit, I'm a self-professed political junkie. There has not been a time that I have not seen either one of you, and when I'm not able to, I TiVo it. And I can quote you all. And this is my issue. This is a paper my mother, who's a graduate of the University of Louisville, wrote 30 years ago. It's esteemed analysis of the media and their coverage of the Democratic Convention in Chicago with McGovern. What she details and the statistics are almost identical to what's going on now. Now, I have an issue with the opinion versus fact, and the fact that this president, President Obama, and Mr. Wolf, you're very guilty of this. He is President Obama, not Obama. That bothers me. He does not get that respect from the media. One, if he does, and then he encountered the worst. If you take all three recessions that this country has faced combined, forget the Great Depression. Those three recessions do not equal what this country just faced. And my question is, why don't you all articulate, why do you let the media get away with these lies? And I feel like that there should be, you all should be able to do something. They should not be able to say to us that, perfect example, with the health care. No, it was not perfect, but the Republicans wanted across state lines for insurance to be able to be bought. Well, once the Democrats said, okay, we'll give you that, they were against it. Why can't you all do more, you as a campaign person, you as the media? I mean, the truth, the media
Thank
has
you.
Now
that,
become...
I think we understand the question now.
I can't help.
Yeah, I think that's one for me. An interesting comparison with 1960. By the way, I meant no disrespect by saying Obama for President Obama. I say Bush, and I've had conservatives complain that we use the shorthand. I mean, President Bush, President Obama is more correct. It's more formal, and especially when you're speaking live or on TV, we shorten it. So it's not a measure of respect or otherwise. I actually have respect for President Bush. I did when I was covering him. I know a lot of my Democratic friends thought that was somehow sort of collaborating. But, you know, I'm afraid you've got to have respect for people who take on this terrible job with its incredible responsibilities, no matter who they are, no matter what they've done. So just to explain that one. 1960, look, you're... people have been complaining about the media for a long time. That's not to minimize the media's failings at all, but the media of 1960 was positively angelic compared to the media environment today. Be honest with you. I look back on those times and think, not only was that a golden era, but you know, when the media was in an extremely healthy situation, although journalists were griping and moaning then just as they are now, that's a fact, a characteristic of the tribe. At that time, you could afford ethics. You could afford to report things. You could afford to send teams of reporters. One thing I've noticed covering successive campaigns is that people now make the argument, oh, you don't need to be out there on a campaign. You don't need to. So you can just cover it by phone and email. And, you know, you can't. It's like saying, I'm going to cover a war by looking at a website. Well, I'm sorry, but journalism is about experiencing these things. It's about asking direct questions and expecting direct answers. And so for all of the faults of 1960, I can see many more faults today. There was a conversation I had in Iowa in early 2008 with a reporter, blogger, who shall remain nameless, who posted an item that we'd all had a conversation late at night with some campaign people. And it was a very interesting bit of conversation in which this campaign person made all sorts of wild allegations about a rival campaign, which were all really interesting. And I woke up the next morning and I thought, right, you know, I've really got to do something about that. And I saw this other blogger reporter and I said, hey, what did you think about that conversation we'd had? And he said, well, yeah, it was great. I've already blogged about it. I said, wow, you're amazing, because I was kind of tired and emotional last night. So I didn't have a chance to call the other campaign and ask them what they think. And this guy said, oh, I didn't bother calling anyone. I just wrote it up. And I went, well, how do you know it was true then? And he said, well, if it's not true, then they're going to call me up, and I'll correct it, and I'll blog it again. And if it is true, then they won't call me. And I hate to sound old, because I wasn't born in 1960, but Just the idea of not checking stuff is really, it doesn't matter in a hyper-competitive media environment. So how do you correct that? With difficulty. It's not something, there was never a monolithic media, there isn't now. The environment is very fast and loose. Maybe it's back to where newspapers were in the 20s and 30s, before people discovered journalistic ethics and standards and that kind of thing. The newspapers were very rough and tumble in the early period. Maybe that's where we're at right now. So I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. In fact, if anything, I think it's going to get worse.
Next question.
Welcome to Louisville, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I have a question about, there's a great concern about the deficit, and if the president, if the administration hasn't made great progress by, say the end of the year or even early spring in terms of prosecution of the war in Afghanistan, given the tremendous expenditure of time and treasure that we're exerting over there, wouldn't that essentially hurt his chances for reelection?
Well, as it relates to Afghanistan or as it relates to Iraq or any other foreign policy or military matter, politics just cannot enter into the discussion at all. Obviously, the Iraq War, the combat operations were brought to an end, as the President announced a couple weeks ago. All the troops will be out of there next year, and that was a fundamental commitment. And by the way, not something that was assured to be done. You might remember John McCain mentioned that he'd love to stay in Iraq for a very, very long time. And in Afghanistan, obviously, the president talked about this every day of the campaign, that he believed that we had taken the eye off the ball, that the threat in Pakistan and Afghanistan was real. There obviously are nuclear warheads all around that region, and it was a very unstable situation. And they were training al-Qaeda operatives at very, very intense levels. And so the president obviously has said that he believes we need to try and destabilize al-Qaeda in that area. But, this is not a situation where, the mission is endless or it's about, rebuilding that country. So I think the Iraq decision and process should give people confidence that the president is very intent on making sure that there is a circumscribed set of objectives, that we're going to measure that maniacally, that we're going to make adjustments to make sure we are achieving them, but that he was serious about having some, timeline here. Because without a timeline, and obviously he said conditions on the ground need to affect that. Any commander-in-chief who doesn't say that would be making a grave mistake, but that this should be not looked at as something that's going to go into perpetuity as we did in Iraq. And I think that's really important. So the politics of it, I don't know. Obviously, there is a fiscal cost. We were spending a lot of money in Iraq every month. We're spending a lot of money in Afghanistan. And obviously, we've got huge needs here at home and a deficit problem. But, all you can do is if you focus on 2012, you're going to let the country down. Most importantly, you have an economic situation that's not sustainable. You've got a deficit situation that has to be addressed and debt together. You've got the situation in Afghanistan. You've got to continue to strengthen our relationships with the rest of the world, not so we're popular, so that we can achieve common results and work cooperatively on so many of these issues that obviously are global. We've got to continue to build the new industries of tomorrow. We've got to deal, and we've got to continue to try and deal with this inequity where the middle class has been shrinking. Listen, in the last administration, it was the worst period on time for the middle class in this country. We had only a net, I think, a million jobs during that entire time, wage stagnation, healthcare cost exploding. I mean, this was an out-and-out assault on the middle class. So that's got to be part of this, too, is what are we doing to make sure that more people can get into the middle class and more people can stay there, and more people in the middle class can aspire to do better than that. So that's all you can do. And I think his approach is, I'm going to try and deal with these problems honestly, I'm going to try and deal with them forthrightly. I'll try and use my best judgment. And then ultimately, the voters will have to decide whether it continues or not. And I think that's the right approach. And, the campaign itself will be important, because I think it may be less important than the 08 campaign, the campaign itself, but of course you could say, well, what if it comes down to one state and 5,000 votes? You know, then the campaign in that particular state. Listen, the Bush campaign of 04, you know, was remarkable in that what they did in the state of Ohio, I mean, they turned out more Republican voters than any of us thought was possible. And that won them the presidency. If the turnout in Ohio had been around what it was in 2000, John Kerry would have beaten George Bush. The Republican Party did a miraculous job of turning out votes. So even in a re-election, campaigns can matter. But ultimately, you know, if you're an incumbent, it's going to be more about your record and where you say, this is what I've done, but this is what I want to continue to doing. This is what my opponent's views are. And then you got to let the American people have at it.
We have time for two more questions. Yes, sir.
I'd like a clarification on your characterization of independents as conservatives. I'm a fiercely independent who campaigned for President Obama, campaigned heavily. And if you are considering me because I'm concerned about deficits and other things as being leaning towards Sarah Palin, I fiercely object to that characterization.
Well, I definitely have to clear that up because I don't want you to have a, you know, scarlet SP on your jacket. But no, my point was that, no, listen, there are plenty of independents that are still heavily aligned with the Democratic Party. So they're independent in registration, but they vote Democratic. Plenty of independents that vacillate. My point is that this particular electorate in 2010 will be comprised of a more conservative element of independence because some Republicans have left their party and affiliate not with a party but independent, but they're more conservative. And the 2010 electorate, if you just look at independents, there will be a more conservative element to that than in 08 or will be the case in 12. But no, there's plenty of independents in just like you who don't affiliate with a party but were an important part of why we got elected, are still involved with the president, and are helping him around the country. So that's absolutely right. It's just, you know, we won independents by 9 points in 2008. You know, my guess is if the same independents were to vote this time, that margin would be a little bit less. But again, that's not to diminish that independents, again, you know, there may be 20% of independents that almost all the time vote Democratic and 20% that almost all the time vote Republican. You know, you've got about 60% in the middle that do vacillate a lot between the two parties. And there's no doubt that Republicans will do better in most states, not all, in most states this year with independents than they did in 08. But I apologize if that wasn't clear.
Before we hear our last question, I'd like to remind everyone that both of our guests, David and Richard, have graciously signed their books in advance. And Carmichael's booksellers will be on hand with those pre-signed books in the lobby as you leave the theater so you can buy copies. Those with tickets for tonight's dinner should go directly across the street to the Humana building. Now let's have our last question.
Hello. I'm part of the satisfied Democratic Party base. And I'm an admirer of President Obama. But getting him into office was pretty painful for some people. With reference to the period before the Democratic Party convention, and remembering that Hillary Clinton won the Kentucky primary, what was the relationship between the national campaign and the local and state campaigns?
It's a really interesting question, and I appreciate your preamble there. That's always welcome.
How much did you lose Kentucky by?
Why don't we move on?
Just fun fact.
Yeah.
Save the best for last.
We were already planning for the general election at that
point.
It's a very interesting question, and I write about this in the book. And our opponents in the Republican Party, who do think that we are, you know, a socialist and all about interest groups, you have to understand that it's about the campaign, about the president. In our history, certainly. In our history since we actually had presidential primaries, because we didn't used to have any primaries. Even when John Kennedy was nominated, I think 13 or 17 states, something in there, had primaries. The rest were just sort of party bosses. You know, sort of outside candidates who don't have a lot of institutional political support never get nominated, and never win the presidency. You know, Reagan by 80 was not that insurgent outsider. He was in 76. McCain in 08 was not that. He was in 2000. So what happened here is quite remarkable. And we were a campaign that had very little political support for a very, very long time. It wasn't until we started winning that some governors and senators started getting on board. We were a grassroots campaign. And so when it was clear we were going to be the nominee, there was some unease out there because Democratic Party interest groups, elected officials, they were used to playing integral roles in the nominee's campaign and therefore playing a central role in the presidential race. And in many respects, driving the campaign. And in our campaign, the political establishment was the caboose, not the engine. People were the engine. And it allowed us to run a really good campaign because we never did anything, you know, in terms of Barack Obama's schedule, the allocation of resources, strategic, based on the whims of a prominent supporter. It was all what we thought was in the best interest of winning and being faithful to our campaign. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, I think he's been willing to take on a lot of tough fights and been successful, is as president, he is also not, first and foremost, responsible to those interests, even interests that I believe in and agree with and like. He's not. And that still, and Richard can attest to this, there caused some unease. So very important. And so there was a transition there. I'll never forget, I was on the phone with a prominent Democratic governor in a very important battleground state who said to me and some of my staff, there was a dispute because he believed that we should do field work and turn out the old-fashioned way, which is you pay the ward leaders and they turn people out. And we weren't doing that. We said we'd help a little bit, but we believe in what we're doing here, which is we are believing in our volunteers. And, you know, he said, you guys with all this happy talk about grassroots, he said, you know, I've never seen volunteers be reliable. You've got to pay if you want the job done. And this governor did not support us in the primary. And I'd say, with all due respect, Governor, those volunteers left a trail of footprints on your back a few months back. And we're going to cast our lot with them. And people just didn't believe in it. And in my view, too many people today still don't. It's almost like, well, that was the Obama thing. You know, that's not how we can run campaigns. And listen, truth is, people would say to me, why didn't Hillary campaign run your campaign? Well, she couldn't. That's not fair to her. You know, she wouldn't have had the same kind of intensity at the grassroots level. I mean, but most candidates, for any party, any office, you need to try and get volunteers involved. Because more and more, because people don't listen to or trust, you know, what institutions say, the media says, even candidates, what they trust is what we hear from each other, right? If my friend or sister or mother says something to me, I'd be more inclined to believe it. You know, you just are. And so you need people out there making your case. You need to register voters. So there was an uneasy period there. And, you know, it never was great. And also, right when Palin was picked, most people thought that was catastrophic for us. Remember that? I mean, it all seems apparent now. It wasn't going to work out for them. But then it was, whoa. This is turning the campaign upside down. McCain's going to win Wisconsin, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, where all those hockey moms and mama grizzlies are or whatever. And so what our party was saying was, okay, you guys, you know, you think you can win Indiana, North Carolina, Virginia, just quit it, okay? This is all about Pennsylvania and Ohio, so let's go focus there. And so what I found in the campaign is when things were going well, everybody kind of, you know, bit their lip. When things weren't going well, people jump in and say, those guys don't know what they're doing. You know, these volunteers aren't going to deliver. They think they can win states like Virginia, Colorado. They're spending too much time on that. So it was very interesting. Now, the truth is, Senator Clinton couldn't have been better. You know, she and Barack Obama, President Obama, set the tone right away, which is, it's over. Okay? Behave. And so all of us who still had some hard feelings shook them off and tried to work together. And that was great. And she couldn't have been better. But there was, and that still exists because, again, it's very unusual for someone. You got to understand, when Barack Obama started running for office and then was elected president, He knew the senators because he served with them. He hadn't met hardly any Democratic governors. If he'd met them, it was just to shake their hands. Members of Congress, party leaders, he didn't know any of them. So it was very unusual for someone like that to become the nominee and then the president. And, you know, I'll tell you this. When you ask him in 2030, let's reminisce about your 2008 campaign, you know, kind of what comes to mind, what animates it for you, it's not going to be, well, I beat John McCain in all three debates, although that was kind of fun, or, you know, boy, that was crazy when Palin got picked, or, you know, boy, Joe Biden said some interesting things. It's going to be, he's going to say it was the people. It was the people of the campaign. And I can't tell you how many times he would leave an event or a state and he would call me and say, I do not want to let these people down. They are working so hard for me. He understood what a special thing that was. And so, anyway, but Richard may have some observations on that because he...
I think that was a pretty good answer, but interesting about the people comment, I'll just pick up on this to end up. We were on the plane early on. And by the way, it's so easy to look back and look at everything through the prism of Obama's victory, President Obama's victory, excuse me. But it really was a not just a long haul, but a long haul that was characterized by these extended periods of at least serious questions, at worst, outright defeat, and then rapid-fire victories along the way, which everyone remembers, but they don't remember everything else. And the period of time when I was writing my book, and I'm sure David found the same thing, I dedicated all of this, all of these pages, all of these words to the primaries, and then found that the general election was like this, and the rest of it was like that. And the truth is that they spent a huge amount of time because of the calendar, because of how long it took. I spent a huge amount of time in this primary phase. And it's only, well, where are we now? The campaign was 21 months, almost 2 years. President Obama has not been in office yet for 2 years. So it's just worth remembering how long a period that was, what a formative experience it was. And I remember speaking to then-candidate Obama on the plane, early on, once the primaries were already rolling, so this would have been sort of February, March, and he said, he was saying how he didn't have to do all of this stuff, he had a great life, and how he wasn't like the Clintons. The Clintons really had to do this stuff. He didn't really have to do this stuff. And I thought it was a sort of late-night plane conversation. It was a bit of a shtick. You know, I just couldn't see. We'd gone through Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and the big rallies, and this was already a phenomenon in terms of the kind of reaction he was getting. And I said to him, you couldn't really just leave all of this because of all the people. And he said, oh, yeah, I could go back doing that. And I said, well, you go back and teach law? And he said, yeah, I could do that. And I just said, well, I don't see how that could be, because you go out there and there, you know, this is a room where, in some ways, it's like a section of one of those arenas we would go to, because there would be this crowd on three layers all around, and it would be arena after arena after arena where the look on people's faces and the sounds they were making were unlike any other political experience I or any other journalist had ever experienced in our lives. And that's maybe why then Senator Clinton said, enough with your big rallies. I mean, they were extraordinary. And so I have to say, in spite of what the candidate said, maybe that was just at that moment, the engagement with the campaign was extraordinary. On both sides, I have to say, the one interesting factor looking forward now is those Clinton voters, those people in Kentucky, those Democrats in Pennsylvania, are they totally sold on this president? Do they feel that he really connected with them? I think, and this is not born out of any poll analysis, I wonder whether that attachment is there, was sealed in the general election, or whether it was temporary. It would be interesting as a sort of journalistic, maybe as a political exercise, to go back to some of those places and say, how have things changed for you? Do you still feel loyal to Democrats, to Obama, if you voted for him in the general election? But you know, it's easy to look back and forget just how long, just how passionate, just how engaged people were. My working theory is that when people invest emotionally in politicians, it's actually very hard for them to forget it. It's very hard to revisit it. And it'll be interesting seeing 2012, whether those same rallies, same arenas are there, whether they want to do them even. But my guess is things are in flux right now. We haven't yet seen where the remnants of 2008 really lie.
Thank you both for coming.